Well, anything good I ever did, nobody ever said a thing. Never said well done or was it okay. But if I tripped up, which invariably I did, because I was new at the game, a ton of bricks came down on me.
It's Friday, yes, it's 5 o'clock, and welcome to the BCFM Politics Show, streaming live on PRSC Radio this week, hopefully back on FM in Bristol soon. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. In the second hour, thousands of British personnel helping create the world's biggest humanitarian crisis in, guess where, Yemen. The poorest country in the Middle East is being ground into the dirt by our great ally, Saudi Arabia, with tens of billions flowing back to the UK in arms sales and paying for the staff who are helping Saudi slaughter the Yemenis. And all to aid so-called President Saleh, who's imposed by the West and who's not even allowed to turn up at the Saudi peace talks for what they're worth. So Somerset's Judith Brown, who worked for the UN in Yemen, is here to explain what our media won't tell us about Yemen, and our MPs don't want to hear about the genocide Britain is profiteering from in the Arabian Peninsula. As a former nurse, Judith's also been outspoken about what she sees as some irrational decisions by Boris Johnson's government over the COVID-19 response, and points out some of these contradictions. Masks were useless, according to the British government and the World Health Organization, but now they're compulsory. How strange. We ask, is the pandemic an Orwellian psychological operation? We're supposed not to notice some of these contradictions whilst our civil liberties are stripped away. So if COVID-19 was man-made, as the former MI6 chief suggested last week, splicing the SARS and the AIDS poisons onto the common cold, are we not dealing just with a pandemic or ID 2020 vaccination ID system, but with an evil agenda to enslave humanity? Well, that's in the second hour after six. Joining me to review this week's news, though, is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Hi, Martin. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hello, Tony.
Now, it's not every week that Bristol makes the news nationally and all around the world, but this week it certainly did, didn't it, with the toppling of the statue of Edward Colston, something that we've been covering actually for most of the last 10 years, the controversy surrounding that statue on this programme, and subsequently tipping it into the drink, and the council now early morning yesterday fishing it out again, saying that it's going to go in some sort of museum on public display, but in a very different context.
That's right. I was there. It was a very big crowd, one of the biggest I've ever seen in Bristol.
How many would you guess?
Well, people were saying something up to 10,000. I don't think it was as much as that, but it was a lot. And, of course, we were trying to physically distance, social distance insofar as possible. So that actually made the crowd bigger in terms of the
room. Oh, okay. So it seemed bigger. But what about the age profile and the racial profile of those who were there?
Well, I would say it was overwhelmingly young people. That's what I would say. I'm not a young person, sadly, but there were lots of people there who were, I would say, mostly under 20. Quite a lot of quite a large contingent of people who were definitely teenagers. And what was inspiring about it for me was how well organised they all were, how peaceful it all was, and there was an awful lot of speeches, very powerful speeches made by not by big name. Politicians or anything like that. It was very much led by the people on the ground. And once the statue had come down, for example, people got up one after the other onto the pedestal where the statue had been and made very powerful, fiery speeches, which included lots of clapping and cheering. And then when we got to the final destination of the demonstration in Castle Park, lots of people carried on having a sort of mass meeting that went on for several hours. And these are all young people, obviously quite new to political action. And it was quite inspiring.
So we mentioned last week, didn't we, that it was, happened on Sunday, and I'd never seen a demonstration which had been actually advertised and plugged so much on the local TV Thursday and Friday there was an announcement that the demonstration was going to be happening even during a lockdown. It doesn't seem that many demonstrations, including some of the ones you've organised and been involved in, Martin, to do with the anti-Iraq war and that sort of thing, don't get this level of publicity. And also, of course, it was spread a lot on social media. Obviously, that's one of the reasons there were so many young people there. But it does seem as if there was a sort of a nod and a wink to the establishment media saying, well, actually, this is going to be a good demonstration. No problem about tipping people off to make them aware of it beforehand.
Yeah, well, I think obviously the video that went around the world showing the death of George Floyd has touched a raw nerve all over the place. And of course, one of the things that we did is we did 8.5 minutes silence in memory of him. And that was a very long silence. And it was, again, carried out with absolute discipline. Loads of people were, as we went into the park, people were handing out water and masks. Lots of things have been thought about. And I think the police behaved impeccably. They realised that there was no point trying to prevent what was going to happen. And they basically just made sure that everybody was safe and that nobody was hurt.
Well, I mean, there's been a national controversy over the inaction of the police. Normally, the police would be expected to intervene in a situation like this to stop the statue, for example, someone climbing on it and putting ropes on it. The police at that point would surely normally intervene to stop it. And one of the candidates for the Police and Crime Commissioner, which is an election that's been delayed until next May, supposedly because of the COVID-19, PCC candidate hits out at the police for surrendering control of Bristol streets. This is Tory candidate Mark Shelford said frontline officers were furious at their weak leader's orders to stand by as protesters took the law into their own hands. Well, you were there.
Well, I think Andy Bennett, who's the chief constable of Avon, he's obviously been...
No, he's not. I think he's operational commander for the city centre. But anyway,
right.
Yeah.
OK, well, I mean, he basically was put on, was questioned about this. And obviously some Tories are very unhappy about this. Richard Eddy, for example, as a councillor, clearly not happy. But I think what he said was quite right. He said, well, what do you want me to do? If I tried to protect the statue, then we would have ended up with a confrontation. And in actual fact, people could easily have been injured in that confrontation. There was a lot of people there. They would have had to have thousands of police if they were going to prevent us doing that. And I think he made the right decision.
Well, what about
decide to prosecute them?
What about Richard Eddy's comment? He said actually that Edward Colston was a hero for Bristol.
Well, I think that just shows how out of touch he is with the feelings of the demonstrators. This statue, as you know, has been a controversial statue for years. And of course, it also speaks to the role of the merchant venturers in Bristol of today. I mean, there was going to be a plaque put by the statue contextualising him, but the merchant venturers carried on watering down what was going to go on the plaque so that no agreement could be made about what the plaque was going to say.
What say do the merchant venturers is having? Something like that? Surely this is just the decision
statue,
for the mayor.
They put it up. It's not even clear that the city council owns the statue. It was originally put up by the merchant venturers in the 1890s. And just as with these Confederate generals in the US, which is so controversial, it wasn't put up at the time that Colston was alive. And in actual fact, throughout most of the 19th century, nobody would have wanted to put a statue to him because of the anti-slave trade campaign.
Yeah, I mean, isn't it?
Mid-19th century, nobody was saying that slave traders were good people. They didn't say that at all. In fact, people like John Wesley and others had campaigned against the slave trade in Bristol. The idea of putting up a statue to this guy would have been reprehensible.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it?
With the conservative generals in the south of the United States.
It's interesting, isn't it, that we've just had, literally the week before, the first ever black woman member of the Merchant Venturers, who's a nightclub owner and a lawyer, from the Lakota Club, Marty. I mean, yet all of a sudden, this seems like the merchant venturers are kind of at the centre of this story, and yet they weren't really mentioned hardly at all in the coverage of it. So who are these merchant venturers?
Well, as you know, Tony, they were founded in the end of the Middle Ages, and they basically are, for many years, they used to run Bristol. I mean, effectively, they were the government of Bristol. And, of course, to join a merchant venture is very difficult. You have to be invited to join. It's not automatic. And I think that she's probably the first black woman and one of the first women ever to be a merchant venture. I think Margaret Thatcher was an honorary member, but other than that, they didn't have any women members. And of course, they made their money from the slave trade. All of the nice Georgian houses up on Clifton and lots of things that were provided.
I'd also point out, ultimately
built on the back of...
I'd also point out the merchant venture of families, the people that formed it in the 1500s, these were the same people that financed the trip of John Cabot in 1497 to discover North America. So it wasn't just the slave trade they were responsible for. They were also responsible for the general early colonization of North America, which led to the deaths of tens of millions of Native Americans. So these guys have got a lot of bad karma.
Well, they have. And I think the kind of arguments that have been made by Boris Johnson this afternoon, that removing statues is removing history, is really missing the point. There's no reason for us to have in modern Bristol a statue in the centre of the city to a slave trader. Now, that doesn't mean that we're just going to throw it. I mean, what's going to happen to the statue? I understand it's been fished out of the dock. And I think it was quite symbolic throwing it in the docks. Of course, 19,000 of his slaves were thrown overboard during his
died on the way across.
They were thrown overboard for the sharks. And he's going to be fished out. And I think the statue, and it's rather, you know, because it's basically been broken now. Bits of it have been knocked off, and it's got paint on it. They're going to put it in the M shed, I think. And that all of the placards that were placed around the pedestal have been picked up, and it's going to be an exhibition about slavery in Bristol.
I mean, the thing interesting, isn't it, how the Labour Mayor Marvin Rees has done absolutely nothing about the whole slavery issue, even though a lot of people have been asking him to do so, like providing space. There was a potential building where there was going to be a some sort of slavery memorial space and kind of museum and a memorial. He's done nothing about this, but then this is obviously going to help him a lot. He's a mixed race, and he's been on all the TV people as it screens around the world, and particularly the national TV here, as if this is his campaign.
Well, in actual fact, he said he's tried to hedge his bets by saying that he doesn't really approve of the statue being thrown in the water, but it shouldn't really have been there in the first place. But I think one thing he did do was that he closed all the streets in the centre of Bristol so that there was no traffic. I mean, that can cause a big problem when you've got up to 10,000 people marching. If you've got a normal traffic on the roads at the same time, that's a potential cause of conflict and disorder.
Okay, yeah, before we get off the subject of the merchant venturers, though, we are witnessing, and you and I in our lifetimes have seen, an enormous reduction of the power of the state, not only nationally, but here in Bristol, local government's power has been denuded massively, particularly by the introduction of the mayor. You know, the local individual councillors we elect have got less and less power. The people who are doing very, very well out of this are those that the merchant venturers have their secret shareholdings in, that is private industry. So what do you make of that big change that's been happening? Because the merchants are quietly doing that, really behind the scenes, with no scrutiny whatsoever. None of their accounts are open. They're all closed. Only the Privy Council is allowed to scrutinise what they're actually doing. And we know, for example, that they have a particular interest in investing in the privatised utilities that have been privatised under Margaret Thatcher and since under New Labour.
Well, as you know, the only time we've ever got a merchant venture on this show was some years ago. And the guy was on the board of Bristol Water, which had just been fined that morning, the biggest fine ever for overcharging of customers. And as a lawyer, I think it's Chris Covington is his name, he said, well, I am going to appeal this. We've made loads of profit from overcharging, and we're not going to accept this result. We're going to appeal it, and we're going to overturn it in an appeal. And that's exactly what he did. And the other thing that the merchant venturers in recent years have done in Bristol is, because of the privatisation effectively of schools, they've started to take over schools. They used to run, or they basically were the patrons of Colston Girls' School and Colston Boys' School, which were private schools. Colston Boys' School remains a private school. It's out in Stapleton. and Colston Girls' School, and plenty of their girls were on the demonstration on Sunday, by the way, they went into the state sector as an academy. But there are still lots of issues about their admissions policy, as Christine Townsend, the educational campaigner, has pointed out.
Yeah.
So I mean, in other words, parents who used to have to pay fees for their kids to go there, now we pay for them to go there.
So this is effectively the privatisation, Martin. This is the privatisation of our country, of all of the basic essential services, which are generally not there as profit-making services. They're there to provide basic utilities to enable the country to function. What's happened is these private interests and private money has moved into making easy money, which is, you know, where basically they can jack up the price to whatever they want, so long as they got one over on the regulators, which they normally do. So this is a kind of new form of capitalism we're seeing these days, isn't it?
Well, it is. And of course, there's a real question about whether a business organization like this should be running schools. They see it as a, you know, as helping the community. But there's also an element of them basically just, I mean, when schools were run by local authorities, if you didn't like what was going on, it was pretty clear what you had to do. You vote for somebody else and they'll change the policy.
Anyway,
when they're run by academies, you've got no comeback on them at all.
One of those utilities that's been slowly, reflecting much more and more the view of the private sector rather than the public sector is the BBC. And the BBC has got a new director general. The director general's role is different from the chairman. The chairman is a sort of kind of titular head of the organisation who chairs the board of governors and I think it was the charity board they had for a while. But anyway, the director general is the day-to-day editorial manager, like the managing editor, like BCFM's manager is Pat Hart, for example. The managing editor of the BBC is the new one, is Tim Davey. The only thing is, Martin, that he is from a company that makes Pepsi Cola, and also from Procter & Gamble, who are involved in making food products. So he's a PR guy, basically, a marketing man. He's now the editorial chief of the BBC.
Well, there's been the rot in the BBC has been going on for years, as you know. And, of course, the test and tracing regime, instead of being carried out by GP surgeries and local authorities who've actually got environmental health officers, it's been subcontracted out to a private consortium led by Dame Dido, I can't remember her second name, whose experience is basically of running things like,
well,
she's on the board of the jockey club, for example.
We heard last week from Kath Viner at The Guardian saying that she would never ever let Seamus Milne back with his excellent, used to be brilliant column on the and he's the guy who then became director of communications for Jeremy Corbyn onto The Guardian. And actually the last decent director general that we had that was even basically independent-minded was Seamus Milne's father, Alistair Milne, who was booted out of the BBC by one of the close friends to the Queen and by someone who was asked to do it by Victor Rothschild. That's Marmaduke Hussey back in the late 1980s. But let's have a listen now to the new. This is the way the BBC is now. This guy from Procter & Gamble, I mean, if you look at many products in a supermarket, you pick it up and you look on the bottom, there's Procter & Gamble's name. Things like washing powders, that kind of thing. And that's what he does. He sells those. And he's now running the BBC. So let's have a listen to him now.
Every individual, whether it's Fran Unsworth, who's now running news, yeah, these are people who have run big chunks of news output, have delivered thousands of hours of first-class broadcasting. You've got to remember the BBC has built trust in a time when many organisations have lost trust. Now, we've had a major problem over the last few weeks. I need to grip that. But the people I'm putting in charge are absolutely trust, and they are very, very strong journalists.
Well, trust is a big problem that the BBC have, Martin. As we know, we've been involved in, for example, their Conspiracy Files series. The idea there seems to be simply to take a bunch of criminals and a very important psychological operation, and the BBC do an hour-long documentary on how there's nothing to see here.
Yes, but at the same time, at least they're doing a documentary about it. And the BBC, even in its watered-down form, is far superior to many private sector alternatives. What's sad about the BBC is that they are being essentially emasculated by government, central governments, because they've got threats to their license fee and so on, which
it does bother me that he feels the need to say, oh, we're very trusted, because my impression is that less and less people trusting the BBC all the time.
Well, I think they've actually had a good COVID war, because people have gone back to the BBC to get what they regard as relatively unbiased information about what to do and what not to do. But at the same time, ultimately, as Winston Churchill, another figure in controversy this week, he said that the role of the BBC basically is, when the chips are down, it's there to propagandise the population. And I'm afraid national TV stations of any kind, there's going to be an element of political control. It's almost impossible to get round it.
And it's
always a matter of degree. Some BBC programmes are excellent, others are not so good, and some are outright propaganda.
I mean, I would suggest that they're generally good, but when it's something extremely important, they usually tell a lie. They will normally steer people.
Yeah, I mean, if you generally got a good reputation for telling the truth, that's when you can tell a lie and get away with it. And that's effectively what they do.
Yeah, so this is all very, very nice for the merchant venturers. They've had absolutely no scrutiny, really, during this amazing event focused on Bristol. Even though they're an incredible, powerful organisation, probably the most powerful in the city, they own the city. Their nickname is the Bristol Mafia. And that's the fact that I picked up off of a documentary made by a guy who's now the National Union of Journalists treasurer in the city and has been for many years. He used to be the head of news and current affairs at HTV before that was emasculated, and that's James Garrett. So I'll put a link up to on our show page to his documentary all about the merchant venturers and a bit about their history and where he talks to them too, just so they get their fair share of coverage, which they seem to have managed to dodge from most of the other media outlets in the city. Anyway, one of the great stars of the coverage, I think, Martin, has been Madge Dresser from Bristol University, the historian, yeah, who's been on many news outlets. And here she is earlier this week on Five Live talking about the various foibles of who this guy Edward Colston actually was.
Although I absolutely understand the anger and the frustration, we've been campaigning peacefully for years to at least have the damn thing replaced, but also to have some memorial, some proper memorial to the contribution that the people, enslaved Africans and their descendants, because that legacy of slavery and disadvantage continued right up until post-war immigration into Britain. It's just fallen on deaf ears or got mired in bureaucracy, and you know there were some vested interests who were in denial about it. And a lot of people don't realize that he was quite a sectarian figure. You know, you didn't get your charities unless you were the right kind of Christian. So if you're Baptist or Quaker, forget it. And if you didn't vote Tory, forget it. So, you know, and a lot of white people don't know about that. And, I think, you know, it's a shame that we're, you know, although I applaud the protest drawing attention to the racial injustice that still continues in the city and the discrimination faced, I think that in the long run, we really need to bring in a lot of people in Bristol who are white, who don't perhaps get the pain and the emotion that people of African Caribbean descent feel. They are terrified about, you know, the mob violence. But I'll just say one thing. I don't condone the mob violence, but I would say that it does concentrate the mind wonderfully when rational debate for decades has failed.
That's right. I think she's referring to London there, Martin. Yeah. Madge has done a great job over the years. I mean, we've even on our show, we've done our little contribution, haven't we, towards drawing Edward Colston to the city's attention, even managing he moved on very shortly after Bishop Mike, after I recorded him lying to some school children in a private service where the merchant venturers had booked the cathedral on their charter day, speaking to the girls in there, where he actually said that any link between Edward Colston and the slave trade was pure speculation.
Well, it might be interesting to put a link up to that, Tony, on our show page at the end of this, so that people can hear what the bishop actually said. I think what's actually happened in Bristol, Bristol has got a very good tradition of non-violent radicalism. So nobody was hurt on Sunday, and there was no danger of anybody being hurt. There were a small group, I think they were Britain First protesters. So in fact, effectively, they were potentially, fascist counter-demonstrators. But there were only four of them, and they were basically by the cenotaph. And what happened, they had community police officers, a WPC and another police officer there, and some of the demonstrators argued with them, and some of them didn't bother. But in any case, there was no intention by anybody to do any damage to the cenotaph, which is not a controversial memorial. We all recognise that
the police are put into a bit of an awkward position there, aren't they? Because if they were to be seen to be defending the statue with this massive public support for it to be pulled down, they would be backing the views of these four Britain First white supremacists or whatever they were.
Yeah, well, I think that again, that was handled very well by the police, and the demonstrators had no intention of fighting with these people or of damaging the cenotaph, which is what they claim to be concerned about. And I think that what we've done last Sunday, the most important thing that people got to remember is it was all peaceful. Nobody was hurt. And I think other demonstrators are going to be taking place over the weekend in London and elsewhere. And the real danger is that we're going to end up with casualties, which I don't think is in anybody's interest.
This Black Lives Matter campaign, though, it is a funded campaign. It's not really what you would call a grassroots campaign. My concern is it ever going to really become a genuine, all-encompassing anti-racism campaign? Will it, for example, embrace the boycott, divestment and sanctions campaign and anti-apartheid campaign relating to Palestine and Israel?
Well, it's interesting you should say that, Tony, because when I spoke to lots of young people on Sunday, black and white, many of them were unaware that Black Lives Matter had got quite a big financial profile. You know, people like Soros and lots of companies have been donating to it. So that there's a certain corporate dimension to Black Lives Matter. But most of the demonstrators there, they certainly were unaware of it. And I don't think that it really...
It hasn't really been discussed. And it plays into this whole idea of getting more media coverage. There are also corporations. It might even be some of the corporations of, helped fund Black Lives Matter. But anyway, let's get back to the US, which
they
is...
certainly have.
Where this all began. And over there, there was a woman called Kimberly Jones who did a viral video about, not about the protest, but about how we win. And here is part of that now.
People feel like their only hope and only opportunity to get some of the things that we flaunt and flash in front of them all the time is to walk through a broken glass window and get it. That they are so hopeless that getting that necklace, getting that TV, getting that change, getting that bed, getting that phone, whatever it is that they're going to get, is that in that moment when the riots happen and if they present an opportunity of looting, that's their only opportunity to get it. We need to be questioning that. Why? Why are people that poor? Why are people that broke? Why are people that food insecure, that clothing insecure, that they feel like their only shot, that they are shooting their shot by walking through a broken glass window to get what they need? And then people want to talk about, well, there's plenty of people who pulled themselves up by their bootstraps and got it on their own. Why can't they do that? Let me explain to you something about economics in America. And I'm so glad that as a child, I got an opportunity to spend time at PUSH where they taught me this, is that we must never forget that economics was the reason that black people were brought to this country. We came to do the agricultural work in the South and the textile work in the North. Do you understand that? That's what we came to do. We came to do the agricultural work in the South and the textile work in the North. Now, if I right now decided that I wanted to play Monopoly with you, and for 400 rounds of playing Monopoly, I didn't allow you to have any money. I didn't allow you to have anything on the board. I didn't allow for you to have anything. And then we played another 50 rounds of Monopoly, and everything that you gained and you earned while you were playing that round of Monopoly was taken from you. That was Tulsa. That was Rosewood. Those are places where we built black economic wealth, where we were self-sufficient, where we owned our stores, where we owned our property, and they burned them to the ground. So that's 450 years. So for 400 rounds of Monopoly, you don't get to play at all. Not only do you not get to play, you have to play on the behalf of the person that you're playing against. You have to play and make money and earn wealth for them, and then you have to turn it over to them.
I mean, what she's saying, Martin, is the game is rigged, particularly for black people.
Well, I don't think there's much dispute about that. I mean, she mentioned Tulsa there. In the 1920s, there was a white riot against successful black businesses, which 300 people were killed. That's in the 1920s. It's virtually within living memory. And until the 1960s, it was virtually impossible for black people to vote in the southern United States.
I mean, is she right that some of the people that are looting...
The federal army to allow people to vote.
So is she right that some of the people that are looting are doing it because they're desperate? They just need something, goods to trade?
Whenever anything like that happens, it's obviously the case that the people that are doing the looting and so on are not the privileged. The privileged are looting by buying shares in the stock market, where the taxpayer has been put on the hook to prop up all these
corporations. Well, actually, I mean, what you're saying is that really
looting on a far bigger scale than people stealing a flat screen TV.
Looters are simply doing something which is going on at the top levels, the richest in society anyway.
Well, that's right. This whole thing about looting, as I say, I mean, the looting is going on Wall Street. It's going on as we speak. That don't forget that the banks were supposed to be solvent and everything was supposed to be fine, and we're now back in business. And in actual fact, that's not the case at all. We've given more money to the banks and the hedge funds in the last few weeks than we gave them in 2008. But everybody's not noticed that because, of course, we've got COVID going on, we've got the Black Lives Matter going on, and so on and so forth. And I don't condone looting. I mean, looting and violence are actually counterproductive if we're going to build a real mass movement to change the society. But you can understand why it happens, especially when, you know, if you look at the videos of police violence in the US, they weren't being like the Bristol police were on Sunday. We've got pictures of people being brutalised, tear gassed, pepper sprayed, whacked with batons. And there's lots of, there are already numbers of dead, you know, on both sides. Hopefully that's not going to happen here, but you know, you can see the dangers here, especially when you've got mass unemployment in the US and everybody's armed. You can see where it's going to end up if we're not careful.
Well, with the last 3 weeks or so, Black Lives Matters has done an incredible job in grabbing the headlines, also in many ways kind of breaking the lockdown rules, and I wonder whether, Martin, you think that's okay or not.
Well, in general, I would say The atmosphere on Sunday was that we're not doing this for fun, and we're not doing it because we want to go to the beach or because we just want to have a good time. We just think that this is the time, you know, because of the, you know, cometh the hour, cometh the time to do something. You've got to stand up and be counted. And that's what definitely my motivation in going.
OK,
I think we achieved that goal. Hopefully,
fulfill our remit talking about local, national and international news just by talking about this Edward Colson story. But look, one of the interesting things that also hasn't been really looked at is the role George Soros has played in funding Black Lives Matter and in making it into a campaign which is less likely to become an anti-apartheid campaign, and also less likely to become a general white and black anti-poverty campaign. And there may be reasons why he's done that. But anyway, George Soros is a very controversial figure. And although there's lots of information out there on the internet saying that he never said it, here he is talking about his past as a 14-year-old in Nazi Germany, where he was
in Hungary. In Hungary.
Nazi Hungary, Nazi-occupied Hungary, helping the Nazis to confiscate material from his fellow Jews.
My understanding is that you went out with this protector of yours who swore that you were his adopted godson.
Yes, yes.
Went out, in fact, and helped in the confiscation of property from the Jews.
That's right.
That would send lots of people to the psychiatric couch for many, many years. Was it difficult?
Not at all. Not at all.
Not at all, Martin, he says. It wasn't difficult to go and help the Nazis confiscate. So he was complicit in the Holocaust against his own people.
Yeah, I mean, what he would argue is, what other option did I have? I was a young boy. I just survived. I think a lot of the attacks on Soros come from other billionaires who don't like his relatively liberal politics. That's perfectly okay for them to chuck money at the political system. People like Sheldon Adelson is the biggest funder of US political. He's the biggest funder, full stop. And basically, he's a casino owner. He owns Las Vegas, and he also very, very pro-Israel. So he's basically pushed the Trump administration into recognizing Jerusalem as capital of Israel and so on. Now,
anyway,
if you're going to have money in politics, and I'm afraid money is in politics, Soros is putting his money into politics is no different from the rest of them.
Anyway, no, we're not going to talk about Edward Colson and the Black Lives Matter protests all the time. We've got to also mention Prince Charles this week. We had a whole thing about him last week and the various mysterious deaths and suicides that surround him and Camilla, particularly around the Highgrove estate, but also of Charles's previous partners. This time I thought we'd have a look at what he's making a lot of. He's definitely not like the Queen, Martin, is he? Because he makes quite a lot of political statements. He seems to be doing more and more all the time. We had one last week about him saying people should go out and start picking for Britain, even though he wasn't really talking about them getting any decent wages for doing it, which is the main reason people don't do it. It's because of the very, very low pay that's offered. But he is becoming much more of a political figure, isn't he? And that may be a difficulty. The head of state is really supposed to keep out of politics.
Yeah, I mean, he's obviously got more strident political views on various matters than the Queen. But the Queen, of course, does also have political views.
Well, yes. She may well have the same sort of views as him. We don't know. But the point is she doesn't talk about it because she's head of state.
Yeah, and I think there is an issue about him, his views, whether you agree or disagree with him. You know, on the environment, for example, he sees himself as a progressive, and yet when it comes to things like architecture, he's seen as a conservative. I think we've got to ask ourselves the question fundamentally is, what is the role of a monarchy in modern Britain? Do we want one at all? And if we do want one, what do we want them to do?
Well, unfortunately, Princess Diana is not going to be queen. But anyhow, let's have a listen to Prince Charles now talking about the pandemic. This is his latest speech where he says that it's time to think big and act now, because we're going to have a big reset. He believes the global economy, and particularly with the influence of climate change, and I suppose the banking crisis of 2008, is in a very sorry state. And he agrees with you, Martin. So it'd be interesting to hear what you have to say to what he has to say here, that we need the big reset. And he's planning to make it happen at the Davos World Economic Forum at the beginning of next year.
We have a golden opportunity to seize something good from this crisis. Its unprecedented shockwaves may well make people more receptive to big visions of change. And global crises like pandemics and climate change know no borders and highlight just how interdependent we are as one people sharing one planet. Over the past month or so, despite the ongoing crisis, I've been encouraged to see the growing calls for a green recovery. We need only look to the United Nations Secretary General, to the IMF, the EU, the Petersburg Climate Dialogue, the Canadian government, the COP26 universities network, and business leaders around the world to see this. And as we move from rescue to recovery, therefore, we have a unique but rapidly shrinking window of opportunity to learn lessons and reset ourselves on a more sustainable path. It is an opportunity we have never had before and may never have again. So we must use all the levers we have at our disposal, knowing that each and every one of us has a vital role to play. Everything I have tried to do and urge over the past 50 years has been done with our children and grandchildren in mind. So I can only encourage us all to think big and act now.
Everything that you've done, I wonder if that includes what happened to Princess Diana. Anyway, Martin, you sound like you're on the same page as Prince Charles, or maybe he's reading from your script.
Well, I think everybody has got to talk about a sustainable recovery. I mean, what else are they going to talk about? The question is, what does that actually mean? Does it mean, for example, debt relief for developing countries? Because if it doesn't, then it doesn't mean anything. And of course, what's actually happening in the developing world as we speak is that because of the crisis, which began before COVID, it began in September when the Federal Reserve started intervening in Wall Street, is that lots of developing countries are now, all the hot money that flowed out there has now flowed back into the United States, propping up Wall Street. And of course, countries like Argentina are being strangled. Now, ultimately, the only way to stop that is to cancel the debt. And if they're not going to do that, then it's just talk, isn't it? All of it.
Yeah, it certainly is. I'm reminded a little bit of the BBC Newsnight clip we played a few weeks ago of David Miliband being recommended as the person who is the best to lead the world right now and sort out the coronavirus. As Prince Charles, is he the right person to lead the world into a global financial reset, being one of the richest people in Britain who is extremely secretive about his wealth, hides behind the veil of his private immunity to what should really be freedom of information requests about various things to do with him, including connections with various ministers, his letters to and from ministers, this kind of thing. He's extremely active in that area. So I thought we'd have a listen now back to his former wife, Princess Diana. And I came across recently a fantastic BBC Arena programme which looked at the Panorama interview that Diana did shortly before she died.
I'm amazed that she's been brave enough to take me on.
And I suppose in love.
Of course.
Whatever in love means.
Here was a fairy story that everybody wanted to work. The most daunting aspect was the media attention. With the media attention came a lot of jealousy. I was a problem, full stop, never happened before. What do we do with her? And I'm a great believer that you should always confuse the enemy. Well, there were three of us in this marriage, so it was a bit crowded.
Did you try to be faithful and honourable to your wife when you took on the vow of marriage?
Yes, absolutely.
And you were?
Yes. Until it became irretrievably broken down.
I hope you can find it in your hearts to understand and to give me the time and space that has been lacking in recent years.
It's a high-risk strategy for a woman who remains, theoretically at least, a future queen, a position that adds constitutional significance to her decision to speak out.
Perhaps before she realised it, she was caught up in the excitement of doing it. After all, it's an exciting business. And had managed to justify it to herself, which again isn't difficult. Why shouldn't she have her say? And ultimately, she was told the finished product was very moving. This before it was broadcast. That was how she reassured me. When I metaphorically threw my hands up in horror, she said, "Don't worry. It's very good. It's moved strong men to tears." Well, I may not be strong, but it damn near moved me to tears, and they weren't of pity. They were tears of frustration.
The Princess of Wales's press secretary, Geoff Crawford, is expected to resign over her decision secretly to record an interview with the BBC's Panorama programme.
So there's a little arena programme. I'll put a link up to that on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. The reason I mention this, Martin, is David Miliband was Foreign Secretary when this clandestine meeting happened in London, which it certainly looks as if, according to Roland Dumas, the former French Foreign Minister, started the civil war, so-called civil war, in Syria. And yet we're expected to condone the idea of him being in charge of the world. In a similar way, you know, there's all so many questions about Charles as to whether he's the right person to lead this global reset, he calls it.
Well, I don't think there's any suggestion that he is going to lead the global reset. He is just being part of the general churn that's going on at the moment. There is going to be a global reset one way or another. The question is, who is going to come out on top as a result of all of this? And of course, we haven't really covered this that much in this first hour, but we're on a collision course for war with China and Russia. And that's the global reset that some people want. They want the regimes in both countries to be dismantled so that they can get access to the resources in Siberia and prevent the Chinese
from pursuing alternative policies in the developing world. Different reset buttons out there that could be pressed. The question is, who is going to press them and who's going to get what out of it? Anyway, let's also have a listen now to another censored piece. I found out that you can't watch this in New Zealand, even though it's from the New Zealand Parliament. And here's an MP talking about the emergency legislation that was introduced in March to deal with the coronavirus. I thought quite an interesting thing for YouTube to have censored in New Zealand.
This is the most anti-democratic piece of legislation being put before this Parliament. I repeat it again, it is anti-democratic. It is against the values of this democracy, this Parliament, our constitutional sovereignty. It is against the principles of law and ethics. This is a bill which effectively gives one person enormous powers. In this case, it could be the Minister of Health or the Prime Minister. I suspect primarily the latter. But in any constitutional democracy, which puts enormous powers into the hands of one person, is by definition not democratic at all. These powers, Madam Speaker, will impact on New Zealanders' daily lives in ways I suspect they can barely comprehend. Outlined in Section 11, give one person the power to say to ordinary New Zealanders where they can stay, who they can see, how they can physically distance, where they can travel, how they can carry out specialist activities. One person alone will be able to dictate to Kiwis how they'll be isolated and quarantined. They will have the power to dictate to you your place, premise, craft, vehicles, even your animals, how we as Kiwis can operate. These powers are enormous and they have been concentrated in one hand. This bill enables the police to enter a home without a warrant. Madam Speaker, the police have never held that power. This bill enables police just on reasonable cause to enter into your home. That somehow if we don't give over these enormous powers to one person in government, then somehow everything's going to go wrong. Well, to use fear effectively as what's been done is a blackmail of a sort, a bribe. It's emotionalism over reason. When human societies lose their freedom, it's not usually because tyrants have taken it away. It's usually because people willingly surrender their freedom in return for protection against some external threat. That's what I fear we are seeing now. Wake up, New Zealand.
Well, that's the New Zealand National Party MP, Simon O'Connor. But the point really, Martin, is nothing to do with what's going on in New Zealand. It's the fact that here we haven't seen any kind of real that sort of opposition from the Labour Party here in Britain. What we've seen, in fact, is the Labour Party seems to want the lockdown to be stronger and to last longer. The complete opposite of the way it's happened in New Zealand. And it does look as if this is all just because the battle lines are drawn along political lines. It's not about what's good for the population.
Well, I think you'll find that the New Zealand Labour Party, who are the governing party in New Zealand, wanted a strong lockdown, and the National Party were unable to block the vote in the New Zealand Parliament, and they got the powers that they wanted, and they are now COVID-free. So they can go back to school, they can do what they want. Not completely, of course, because the rest of the world economy is in ruins. And the New Zealand depends on it.
Why haven't the Labour Party been doing something similar here, challenging on civil liberties?
Because they basically, and I agree with them, they basically saying that then if you look at public opinion in Britain, it's overwhelmingly in favour of lockdown. There's a minority that don't like lockdown, but the majority think that we should. You know, we're actually coming out of lockdown now. We should have locked down at the beginning, like we did in New Zealand.
This is the public driving Labour's policy rather than politics. Anyway, what about Keir Starmer? Because I noticed five questions to the new Labour leader Keir Starmer this week, put out by Matt Kennard. The public deserves answers, he says, about the UK's new opposition leader. And I mean, I'm not expecting you to answer them all, but I'll just put the five questions to you and you can see what you make of them, because there's an immense amount of criticism of Starmer and his previous role. Why did you meet the head of MI5, he says, the Domestic Security Service, for informal social drinks in April 2013, a year after you decided not to prosecute MI5 for its role in torture? Question number two, he says, when and why did you join the Trilateral Commission, and what does your membership of this intelligence-linked network, which was created by David Rockefeller, entail, which is a sort of a wider geographical version of the Bilderberg Group? What does what did you discuss with the U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder when you met him on 9th of November 2011 in Washington, D.C., at a time you were handling the Julian Assange case as the public prosecutor? What role did you play in the Crown Prosecution Service's irregular handling of the Julian Assange case during your period as DPP, Director of Public Prosecutions? And finally, why did you develop a close relationship with the Times newspaper while you were the DPP? And does this relationship still exist? So some awkward questions there, really, by Matt Kennard for your Labour Party leader, Keir Starmer. He sounds to me as if he's, he's been one of the main people, for example, behind the illegal, many would say, prosecution of Assange.
Well, the fact of the matter is that Keir Starmer is an establishment politician in a way that Jeremy Corbyn was not. And that's, from many respects, that just sums it up. I mean, basically, he is not from the left of the Labour Party. Let's make no doubts about it.
Okay, well, anyway,
that, of course, to some people, makes him more electable rather than less.
Matt is talking there. I'll put a link up to that on our show page. It's from the Grey Zone, that one. And whenever I listen, I mean, we're talking about the security service MI5 there, but what about MI6? What the former member of the Bilderberg conference was the former boss, Richard Dearlove, of MI6. And the Bilderberg conference, funnily enough, Martin, hasn't taken place this year, supposedly due to the virus. The last couple of weekends are the weekends that it would normally have taken place, including this weekend. Do you think they've met or not? Can we trust them?
No doubt these people are still in communication, Tony. You can be sure of that. And of course, Dearlove, who was basically, he said that Corbyn could never be prime minister because he was a security risk. So Dearlove has got a track record of being a highly politicised head of MI6 and former head of MI6.
Anyway, Dearlove was on the Daily Telegraph's podcast, which is called Planet Normal, talking about this, really as having a kind of little chuckle with the Daily Telegraph journalists about how Corbyn would have been a security risk, so thank goodness he was never prime minister. But then they went on to talk about the possible risk of Hinkley C and other nuclear stations being funded by China, as well as the possibility that China manufactured the COVID-19 vaccine. So let's hear a clip from that now.
A paper on COVID-19 has just been published by the Quarterly Review of Biophysics Discovery by the Norwegian virologist Birger Sorensen and Professor Gustav Gleish of St. George's Hospital at the University of London. I know you've been involved with this, and I know it's very complicated stuff, but basically it involves a detailed etiology of the virus, which they need to create a vaccine. Now, Sorensen and Dalgleish say that the RNA sequence of the virus includes inserts which could not have occurred naturally in zoonotic transfer. Now, for the benefit of non-scientists, including me and you, I think.
Including me.
That means the coronavirus was engineered in a laboratory. Richard, do you think those findings are reliable? I mean, I think people would be reeling.
Well, I have read this paper many times in draft, and it's been rewritten many times. And I think that the importance of the paper is that it is written by two very knowledgeable scientists, one a world-leading virologist. Well, both of them are, actually. It's been peer-reviewed extensively. It's been printed in a journal which is most prestigious. And I think it is a very important contribution to a debate which is now starting about how the virus evolved and how it got out and broke out as a pandemic. I mean, I'm not a scientist. I'm not really prepared to speculate very far, but I think this particular article is very important, and I think it will shift the debate. But I mean, let's see what happens, because there will be scientists with other views who I'm sure will dispute this finding. But as I understand it, it looks as though the theories that Sorensen in particular puts forward are based on some quite important discoveries about the virus, which other people have not hitherto observed. Well, I suppose it raises the issue, if China ever were to admit responsibility, does it pay reparations?
Mm.
I mean, obviously you can't change the sort of aggregated human tragedy that is represented by the pandemic. But I think it will make every country in the world rethink how it treats its relationship with China. It's important that we do not put any of our critical infrastructure in the hands of Chinese interests. So telecommunications, Huawei, our nuclear power stations, and then things that, you know, we require and need in a crisis, like PPE.
So that's Sir Richard Dearlove there, former head of MI6, the Foreign Intelligence Service. Martin, you know, he's basically saying there that he thinks the Chinese might have done it. If they admit it, there need to be reparations. And anyway, we should be extremely cautious about allowing any kind of Chinese investment in Hinkley C, the new big nuclear power station being built right now down in Bridgewater.
Well, Dearlove has got a political axe to grind. There's an attempt to basically, as we know, that Trump is trying to basically crash the Chinese economy. And as he said, there are other scientists who say that it possibly isn't a man-made virus. If it is a man-made virus, Dearlove has also said, well, it must have leaked by accident. The Chinese aren't going to leak a virus into the Wuhan province by deliberately. They're not going to do that. So if it was a leak by the Chinese, it's an accident. And of course, states can't be sued anyway.
Is it feasible that it was deliberate?
Well, if it was deliberate, and I think it is feasible that it was deliberate, then it was done by the Western intelligence services to wreck the Chinese economy and to allow them to bail out Wall Street for the second time in a decade.
Anyway, the point I'd make is that we reported this back the beginning of February. On this show, the first week in February, we were discussing an article by Zero Hedge, and I'll put a link up to that on our show page, saying coronavirus contains HIV insertions, exactly what he was just saying, stoking fears over artificially created bioweapon. And this was done by a couple of big virology departments in New Delhi, including at the university. Then what happened was the next day, Twitter banned Zero Hedge after it posted coronavirus conspiracy theories. I'll put a link up to that too. That was CBS News reported that. And then so we get 4 months later. That is literally 4 months, Martin, and suddenly Richard Dearlove pops up saying basically what Zero Hedge said back at the beginning of February.
If it was deliberate by the Western intelligence services, only a certain number of people will know what's going on. But an awful lot of people have jumped on the bandwagon of saying that the Chinese deliberately infected themselves. I think the Chinese realized that this is a bioweapon. They carried out a biological warfare response mechanism to control it. And I think that the West allowed that to happen, or that they were expecting the Chinese to be knocked down by it, but they weren't. And they were perfectly happy for it to flow back over the United States because they needed to bail out the banks. And if they'd not had the COVID-19 crisis, everybody would be screaming blue murder. Why are we shoveling money down the banks' throats? And of course, that's the real potential. If it is a deliberate act of war, it's an act of war by the Western powers.
You and I were right on the case very soon after the September the 11th attacks. One does wonder if something similar to the 2008 bailouts has been happening here, the whole world basically being bamboozled by the banksters.
Absolutely. And of course, what happened after the 9/11 attacks, the dot-com bubble had burst. They wanted to bail the banks out, but there was no real excuse to bail the banks out. And then 9/11 happened, and suddenly, because of this, we're going to bail the banks out. And it's very strange that all of these weird events happen just at the moment when the banks are about to collapse so that they can have another tranche of money. And of course, what's that doing is putting US taxpayers on the hook for all of the fraud and basic malfeasance that has been going on in Wall Street.
Well, you might be branded a conspiracy theorist for saying things like that, but somebody else who is...
If Richard Dearlove can say it as a former head of MI6, I think well, Irish
he's saying it, he's saying it was an accident. He's saying he thinks it was an accident. Anyway, somebody else who predicted the Bill Gates' involvement in a pandemic, and we have seen an enormous influence of Bill Gates in the COVID-19 funding the people who've come up with the various policies, including John Hopkins University, who's been tracking it, providing all the many graphics for people like the Financial Times and the Daily Mail and the Daily Telegraph, these people. Bill Gates, I thought it was amazing that back in May 2017 at AV7, there was a talk by a guy called Dr. Graham Downing, and these are a series of talks, these alternative view talks, organised by a former colleague of Martin and I's from the 9/11 Truth Group in the 2000s, in the noughties. And this is a clip here from Dr. Graham Downing, where he talks about the bill. In fact, the title of his talks was "The Bill Gates Agenda."
And this is the chief medical officer. Look at this. This was her little story. So this was her imagining the future. This is quite a few years ago now. She said, look, a few years later, shortly after Josh joined the primary school, the government passed new laws, making it a criminal offence for the infected to be in public. There were talks of random tests in the street. And if you were contagious, you would be committed to one of the isolation sanatoriums that were being built on the edge of all major towns. This was a death penalty. They were referred to as the colonies. Do you know, I still find that disturbing all these years. That's a chief medical officer. So do they know something we don't? And there's another guy warning us about this flu. So they're all going at it. So the question is, if I can see that data, excuse me, if I can see that data, why can't they? Is there a conflict of interest? Is there pressure? I know other people have got another narrative for this. Well, this is UK data again. I'm not going to name this guy. He's not put himself up as a public figure. He's just one of the scientists. This is Dr. X. Okay? Now, this is one of the UK studies. Now, he declares lecture fees and travel grants from a drug company. Well, he works for Public Health England. Now, this may be, he didn't receive a lot of money, maybe, or maybe that's just the way it's done. But do you not think that the scientists that are working for Public Health England should be absolutely separate from the drug companies? Do you not think that should happen? Another one, Dr. Y, declares no direct interest. However, University of Surrey, which he's a part of, is involved with something called FluCop and something else. Now, he works for the Royal College of General Practitioners in Surrey. What's FluCop? This is FluCop. It's drug companies. Look at all the people that are in this. All the universities and all the drug companies, all side by side, funding and working with each other. University of Oxford, University of Surrey. So you see lovely studies come out. See, these drugs are amazing. I'm not suggesting they're lying, but I think it's very hard to bite the hand of someone that's feeding you. You know, I really do. This is the company that makes this particular vaccine that goes up your kid's nose and causes that bacteria to increase in the nose. Well, they're part of AstraZeneca, and AstraZeneca is part of that FluCop. And this is this whole lovely little thing where they all work together. Now, this is Dr. X, who's on that thing. Sounds really mysterious, Dr. X. I had a look into him and his expense reports. Now, he's been funded by three drug companies to work at Porton Down. Now, Public Health have got a lab there, apparently. I was under the impression that was for biological weapons. I could be wrong. It's a matter of public record. I'm not saying anything. I just found that interesting. So, Mr. Gates, we're a bit vulnerable right now. If something that spread very quickly, like, say, the flu, that would be quite fatal. That would be a tragedy. A tragedy. Because we've got to break down those organisational barriers. Now, is it the Ides of March? Is he a bogeyman? Or is it a perfect storm? I'm going to stick with a perfect storm, although I know others would have a different thing. And there's the Spanish flu, and here's the next pandemic that he's threatening is going to happen. So there's an increase in H1N1 infection. We are getting increased infections and also being susceptible to H1N1. We've got an increase in bacterial colonization, which just before the flu. We're creating that in the children now. And we had the pandemic. And who knows when that one's going to come. I'm more than happy for someone to shoot this down. But I think at the very least that questions need to be asked. because from what I'm seeing, they're not making it better, but they are absolutely making it a lot worse. Now, let's have a watch them again.
An epidemic, either naturally caused or intentionally caused, is the most likely thing to cause, say, 10 million excess death.
Well, that's the voice of Bill Gates at the end there. And the talk there was given in May 2017 at Alternative View, organised by Ian R. Crane, who now apparently is getting better after being extremely ill a few weeks ago in hospital. Martin, it does seem as if there's the really pernicious aspect of all of this is the rotating doors, the revolving doors, with the drug industry right in the middle of government. And we saw that, didn't we, with Professor Neil Ferguson, who was subsequently sacked. But, you know, Bill Gates was basically his boss.
Well, I mean, the conflicts of interest are palpable. But I think coming back to the main story, the Times of Israel reported that the Israeli Defense Forces were told by the US Defense Intelligence Agency that a pandemic was coming out of China in November 2019. And if when we look at the timelines, it'll become obvious what's going on.
And if it becomes
clear that the West, if it is the case that the West has carried out a biowarfare attack on China, then World War III has already started.
Well, Bill Gates, even himself there, is talking about an intentional release, potentially, of that virus.
Yeah. And that's a bit of a Freudian slip, isn't it?
Well, I think that's what he meant to say. I mean, you know, certainly these things have been being modelled for many years. And I just have to take my hat off to Dr. Graham Downing for bringing that to our attention. All the stuff that seems to be happening now, or certainly much of it is happening now, back in May 2017. What's that, three whole years ago? Anyway, I thought I'd finish this week with William Cooper, who he's somebody who's on our show right at the very beginnings many weeks, but he was a talk show host in the United States. And although Alex Jones, the shock jock from Texas, is somebody who many people have adhered to in the past, certainly when we played a few clips from him, but he is, I would suggest, when William Cooper was killed by the FBI just after the 9/11 attacks, and by the way, Cooper predicted the 9/11 attacks pretty precisely, saying that bin Laden was going to be involved in and fitted up for an enormous attack, a big attack on the United States, and that's what happened. And then he was killed just a couple of months after that. Here's William Cooper talking about what he thinks, and he used to be in the U.S. Naval Intelligence and run his own radio station in the U.S. on shortwave and locally in and around, I think it was Eager, Arizona, actually. And then just down the road in Texas, up popped Alex Jones doing a kind of fake version of Bill Cooper. So let's have a listen to Bill now talking about what he believes is the way that things are really run. And he says it's a Luciferian agenda.
There's a method to their madness. There's really not much method to yours, because you're operating from a place of ignorance. And until you change that, you're going to be bumbling around, bumping into each other, saying and doing the wrong things, not understanding the nature of your enemy. And if you don't understand the nature of your enemy and the weapons they use, you cannot fight that enemy. You can't fight the battle. You shouldn't even be on the battlefield. That's why you're losing the war. And don't tell me you're not, because I'm in a place of great knowledge about who's winning and who's losing this war. And I can assure you, you're losing the war. Doesn't mean it can't be turned around. But it'll never be turned around until you learn what you need to know. You don't even recognize half the weapons that they use against you. And some of them seem so insignificant that you don't even try. They want to create a world where everybody is happy all the time, doing all of the things that, if you're from a good religious upbringing, is wrong to do. If you're not from a religious upbringing, but you have a good brain and you understand the purpose of morals and ethics, it's still the wrong thing to do.
if you're a thinking person. And then the priests had an army. Oh boy, weren't they happy with that? Their whole purpose throughout history has been to teach a small number of people how to become adept at controlling everyone else and presenting their societies as desirable to the profane, so that you'll go knock on the door and say, hey, can I be a member and be initiated? With the promise of learning some great secret. What is that secret? The secret is what I have just told you this morning. The secret is how to control everybody else. And you never understand how to control everybody else until you get to the top of this pyramid of initiation. Most people never make it past the third step. All above that are carefully chosen and nurtured and taught. And Americans, for all these years, have been looking around for the enemy. They've never been able to find an enemy. So those who control them were able to control them even better by giving them an enemy. That's what Stalin and Churchill and Roosevelt determined at Yalta. Who was going to be the enemy post-war? Turned out to be Stalin. And there was going to be this phony Cold War so that the population would never discover the real enemy. And I'm talking about the population of the Soviet Union as well as the rest of the world. You see, the enemy has always been here. It's your uncle, your aunt, your father, your mother, your brother, your sister, your nephew, your nieces, who belong to the fraternal orders collectively known as the Mysteries. The very highest degrees of which, combined together, make up a secret order known as the Illuminati. Their goal is to destroy all existing religions save theirs, all existing governments save theirs, and shackle the mob in a system of eternal oppressive debt chained to a computer for the rest of their life, in a propagandized world to make them believe that they are happy in this system. Now, do you think they're succeeding? Yes. Haven't I described to you just now exactly what is going on in the world today? Yes, they're succeeding. They're succeeding because the American people don't understand their enemy. They don't even know what's happening.
So that's William Cooper there. I must admit, I mean, you know, you don't necessarily have to go along with what he's saying about it being a Luciferian philosophy or the Mysteries. But certainly I do feel chained to a computer far much longer than I'd really like. But Martin, what about this? I mean, one of the interesting things he's talking about there is there's this systematic ignorance, which I think we could probably agree on. It seems to be now that there are enormous amounts of effort go into making sure that people are kept in the dark.
Well, also, even people who try to investigate are bamboozled by all sorts of psychological warfare tricks. So the way in which this COVID-19 crisis has developed, first of all, it's treated as if it's an accident. Then we start to hear the drumbeat, oh, no, the Chinese did it. It's actually a virus that they've created. And, of course, what you're setting up is a war. That's what's going on there. And basically the people behind that are psychological warfare officers. That's what they do.
That's right. I mean, they're trained by the military, aren't they? But then they also do work extensively in the private sector. Sometimes they leave the military after being trained as a psychological warfare officer and add a zero to their salary. So it'll go up from, say, £30,000 up to £300,000. And they work for somebody like Strategic Communication Labs.
Well, that's right. And of course, there's a constant struggle over narrative. And of course, we're playing our part by trying to stick our tuppence halfpenny into the struggle.
We certainly are. And I mean, you've definitely got the psychological warfare going on within the mass media. But then on the ground, Martin, there are a few little organizations like Black Cube that actually do take a very active role, sometimes, literally assassinating people on the ground. And in fact, Black Cube employees themselves sometimes get assassinated back. So it's not just about what people see and hear in the mass media. There are also little operational units on the ground.
Well, there's I sent you a very interesting article this week, which is about a guy called John Rendon, who worked within the military for years in the US and then basically became a PR strategic communications person. And he basically seemed to know everything that was going to happen in the COVID crisis months before it actually happened. I think you better have a look at that and you'll see.
We'll get to the bottom. We'll put a link up to it on our show page at thisweek.org.uk.
There's too many people who knew too much about this supposedly extraordinary event before it happened.
Thanks very much to our guest. That's Martin Summers, Irish Republican Labour activist. Join us in a minute as we join Dr. Judith Brown and take a look around the world and at the virus.
Stop now. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Stop now. What's that sound?
Well, that is Chumbawamba from 1993, one of the Peel sessions, and Time Bomb. Welcome back to BCFM's politics show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, now departed, and me, Tony Gosling. Thousands of British personnel helping create the world's biggest humanitarian crisis in Yemen. We hear the details now. The poorest country in the Middle East being ground into the dirt by our great ally, Saudi Arabia. The unelected monarchy in charge there, with tens of billions flowing back to Britain in arms sales and paying for staff helping the slaughter of the Yemenis. And all to aid the so-called President Saleh of Yemen, imposed by the West, who's not even allowed to turn up at the Saudi peace talks for what they're worth. Somerset's Dr. Judith Brown, who worked for the UN in Yemen, is here to explain what our mass media won't tell us and our MPs don't want to hear about the genocide Britain is profiteering from in the Arabian Peninsula. As a former nurse, Judith also was outspoken about what she sees as the irrationality of the government's COVID-19 response and points out some of the contradictions. Masks were useless, according to the government and the World Health Organization, but suddenly they're compulsory. How very Orwellian. We ask, is the pandemic a psychological operation where we're not supposed to notice these contradictions? And they strip us eventually of our civil liberties bit by bit. If COVID-19 was man-made, as the former MI6 chief Richard Dearlove suggested, you just heard him in the first hour last week, splicing the SARS and the AIDS poisons onto the common cold, are we not dealing just with a pandemic or ID 2020 vaccine ID system, which we all are supposed to partake in, but also with an evil agenda to enslave humanity?
My name's Judith Brown. I started my life as a nurse and ended up as an aid worker, working in Africa and in the Middle East, which I loved, in Lebanon and Yemen. I was a manager of refugee health programs, so I went to places where there were refugees, first of all into Burundi, where there were Rwandan refugees, Lebanon, where there were refugees from Palestine, and then later into Yemen, where there were very generous to refugees and had a lot of refugees from Africa and also other Middle East countries, although they were a minority, places like Iraq, for example, the refugees from Saddam Hussein's regime. To my mind, there's one thing that's remained really constant, and that is wherever refugees come from and wherever refugees go, in general, refugees are not welcome. And I've never known a country which has been very receptive to refugees. Ultimately, they have to accept them, but there is discrimination against them. In fact, I think that Yemen, if anything, was one of the most accepting countries of refugees, but still underneath it, there was a sort of resentment that perhaps Somali refugees could get jobs and poor Yemeni people couldn't, and that was a fact.
So what were you actually doing as part of that job?
I was, Yemen has a very different program to everywhere else because refugees weren't housed in camps, but because Yemen was so poor, there was a refugee program for urban refugees. And so it was a question of organizing health centers, making sure that ordering medicines in for the health centers so that they were equipped, appointing staff, negotiating with the UN, both in terms of the things that they were going to fund in the program, and also negotiating when you had people who had quite severe healthcare problems that couldn't be coped with in Yemen, negotiating with third countries so that they could be repatriated to a third country.
So Yemen is the world's biggest humanitarian crisis right now. I mean, I think we're looking at literally hundreds of thousands of dead. After, is it now around about 4 years of fighting?
Five and a half years of fighting.
Crikey, yes. It's amazing how time flies, isn't it?
Yeah,
and how are they coping now we're in this international pandemic? Maybe we could start actually just by looking at the toll that this has taken on Yemen, and maybe why you think Yemen is the place where this has been happening, somewhere you're quite familiar with.
Yeah, well, actually that in a sense, is a question that that I haven't been able to answer for myself in 5.5 years, because there's no logical reason why Yemen should be destroyed by its neighbours, except, of course, that Yemen... Yemeni people have tended to have more democratic and tolerant attitudes than most of
it. Didn't they? I mean, it was an ex-British colony. Didn't they have a Marxist government at one point?
They did in the south, yes, not in the north, and the north is the most populous part. But they had really tried for a democracy. It's the only republic in the area. All the others are absolute monarchies, like Saudi Arabia, Oman, you know, its neighbours, and lots of the other GCC countries. So, in fact,
that's
all
the Gulf Cooperation Council.
Gulf Cooperation Council countries, Kuwait. They're all absolute monarchies. Of course, now you've got a situation where the other two that aren't absolute monarchies, Iraq and Syria, are also being destroyed bit by bit.
Well, yeah, but these absolute monarchies, I mean, obviously it's not democratic, but they're incredibly prosperous. Places like Bahrain, Emirates, Saudi Arabia?
They are prosperous, but the interesting thing is how much their wealth has actually been going down in the last 5 years since they've been partaking in these wars. I mean, for example, the funds in Saudi Arabia have already gone down by a third in 5 years. So it is quite interesting, because I think that sooner or later the non-stop fighting of wars is going to exact an economic toll on those countries, and maybe make them more vulnerable to Western pressure.
Well, possibly. Anyway, let's look at the actual toll in Yemen. How's the country been transformed over these 5.5 years?
Well, I think that the main thing that's caused most of the damage is the overhead aerial bombardment. I personally think that none of the parties that are fighting in Yemen deserve any support. I know some people think that the Houthis deserve support, but they're the remnants of the old monarchy. And the things that they're doing are as barbaric as any other group. And so,
are they both supported? I mean, the various factions in... Maybe you could just take us through who they are. And are they supported from outside the country, or what?
Yes, both Saudi Arabia has long, over decades, been supporting groups in Yemen that destabilise the government in Yemen, and are supporting a lot of militias there now. UAE is also supporting militias, and generally speaking, the militias of UAE and Saudi Arabia spend a lot of time fighting each other. But the aerial bombardment, which has been going on, has actually destroyed much of the infrastructure, the economic infrastructure, which has made work in Yemen totally.
What I've heard is that there are no military targets left in Yemen.
No, but they seem to do quite well at bombing a lot of civilian targets. And of course, there are still a lot of militias on the ground. So where they know that those militias are located, then they are also targets. But a lot of the things, for example, if there was a cholera outbreak, the targets tend to be water plant, a sewage plant, and hospitals that have been built for cholera victims. So there seems to be a targeted pattern there. Also, there's been a pattern in targeting a lot of agricultural units, so that people in Yemen can find it much more difficult to grow and move their own food around.
Okay, so it's not just the military victims, you know, the people who have been bombed, killed, shot. It's also those that have been dying of starvation and dying of diseases as well.
Yes.
So it's a pretty horrific situation.
It is.
I mean, can we just go back and clarify the main factions involved here?
Well, the main factions, well, obviously one that you've heard of, the Houthis, they're the remnants of the old Mukallawite Kingdom of Yemen. They were absolute monarchy in Yemen.
Oh, so is this before...
Before 1967, oh, okay. before 1960s. And because... because they were the remnants of the old kingdom, then they had been denied a lot of benefits by the rulers of the republic. And eventually a lot of people became very poor. That's from the Bakil tribe that mostly the Houthis are drawn from. And because they became so poor and impoverished, a movement was started, which is not a tribe, called Believing Youth. Then that that tribe eventually was attacked by the government. It was just a movement. It didn't have any militias. But because they were constantly attacked by the government, Saleh, the president, they eventually became a militarized unit and became very good at at fighting, because they'd been fighting the government.
Okay, so we're looking at Saleh and... And I probably pronounce it badly, Saleh and the Houthis, but the two basic factions.
Yeah, there were two basic factions. But then, strangely enough, at the beginning of the war, Saleh and the Houthis joined forces against Hadi, and who was the incumbent president. Obviously, most of the Yemeni forces backed Saleh and the Houthis, which meant that Hadi hadn't got an army in Yemen that he could ask to fight on his behalf. So what he did was ask Saudi Arabia if they would fight to restore him.
And they kindly stepped up to the plate. Wonderful Saudi Arabia. So, but the British are very, very much involved in this, aren't they?
They are indeed. The British particularly...
We British, should
yeah,
I say.
Yeah, the British are particularly involved, because it's not just the sales of weapons, which a lot of countries are doing, but they actually supply under what they call existing contracts 7,000 personnel that keep the war machine oiled and moving. They even do things like, for example, loading bombs onto planes. So if the British pulled out, in fact, the war would have to stop within 2 weeks.
Well, we're talking about thousands of people, but they're not all British, are they? Are the British employing them and kind of, yeah, being managing those
I
people?
I think there are 7,000 British people. Those companies may be employing some other personnel, but there are actually 7,000 British people working on the war effort. Some of those are military and some of them are civilians, but there are 7,000 British people there.
Well, that's an incredible number. And so what about the control from abroad? Because I think that's the interesting thing, especially when you get a president that suddenly finds that he can't command an army in his own country and he has to get help from abroad. So there's obviously a lot of it outside interference.
Well, it's interesting with Hadi, who is the least charismatic and least popular person in Yemen. For example, if when Theresa May went to Saudi Arabia to talk about the Yemen war, she never met Hadi. She only met the people from Saudi Arabia, the foreign ministers, the war ministers and whatever of Saudi Arabia. So he's not only sidelined by his own people, but he's also sidelined by the people that are so-called fighting on his behalf. His views are never important. He's never interviewed. He's of no significance to them whatsoever. And even one of the BBC people, she went to a peace conference about a year after the war started, and she was talking to people then from Arab countries, and they actually said, well, Hadi is never going to, he's of no consequence, he's never going to be president again. And although a lot of people thought that, to actually hear his allies that were meant to be fighting in order to restore him actually making that statement openly was, you know, quite eye-opening.
Well, also, of course, one of the reasons that he's still in power is because he gets a credible reporting from the Western press. I mean, how has that happened?
Yes.
Even though, as you say, he's uncharismatic and that he's got no support or whatever.
Yeah, I know. It's he's just the excuse. You know, people. In fact, though, people, when they talk about your war in Yemen now, they very rarely talk about the restoration of Hadi to the presidency. But it seems to have gone a bit out of fashion. But of course, I think that one of the quite interesting things that's happening in Yemen at the the moment is there is an incredible death toll of disease going on, and two things have happened recently. First is that there have been absolutely incredible floods like Yemen has never known before, and with those floods have come huge quantities of mosquitoes, and with that, of course, lots of disease. And following on from that, the first cases of the coronavirus were identified. And so there's a phenomenal number of deaths now. If you look at people online, they're actually saying things like, something terrible is happening in Yemen. I'm constantly getting messages that my family members are dying. And a lot of people are actually saying, we don't think this can all be caused by the coronavirus, because they see the percentage of people that die in Western sort of outbreaks and compare that to what's happening with their family members. Well,
so the next question's got to be, where are good places to go online to follow what's happening in Yemen? Because we're not getting it on... We get the odd report, you know, say, for example, on ITN or Channel 4 News, which is saying, oh, it's really terrible what's happening here, but it just comes without the analysis. So yeah, exactly. Is there anywhere to go for that?
Well, I mean, I think the best news source is Middle East Eye, but there is a research organisation called the Sana'a Centre for Strategic Studies, which is mostly Yemeni academics, and they do an analysis every month of what's been going on during the last month, and also they take various topics and they analyse them in depth, and I think that that's where you probably get the best information.
Okay, so we'll put some links up to that on our show page at thisweek.org.uk.
Yeah. There is an interesting thing with the militias paid for by UAE. They do tend to be extremist Sunni militias, and certainly there have been reports by, for example, AP, that that what UAE did was to recruit people from Al-Qaeda to actually be paid and work for one of their...
Okay, so there seems to be a whole industry out there of extremist Sunnis who go from one bunch of militias or terrorist groups to the other, whoever seems to be paying the most.
I think, yeah, that is true. And if you're very poor, whoever pays the most and stops your family from starving is important. I mean, some areas like Taiz, where there are different groups fighting in different areas, I have heard, and from several sources, that some people fight for one side in the day and the other side at night. So, because that's the only way that they can support their family and stop them dying, which proves that they're only fighting in order to keep bread on the table. But there are other groups, and particularly these ones that are being employed by UAE, that actually they obviously see the Houthis in particular as being sort of like funded by Iran. To an extent they are, but there weren't so much at the beginning of the war. But so there is a sort of like an ideological anti-Shia reason for them joining in those.
So, I mean, these things are often painted, like the Northern Ireland conflict was, as, you know, Catholic versus Protestant, in this case Sunni versus Shia.
Yeah.
It seems that there's a bit more to it than that.
Oh, there is, but a anyway, lot more. Yeah.
We're talking about the coronavirus out in Yemen and the horrible situation out there, but I know you're also quite critical of the way that the virus has been being dealt with by the British government. I've spoken to you about this before when I was out in New Zealand, and I was quite refreshed to see that you brought this kind of critique to it all. I'm seeing a lot of stuff on the TV at the moment, particularly television news, saying things like the rise in the number of casualties, or the rise in the number of victims. Well, of course it's going to be a rise, because you're totalling it up day by day, even though when actually the number of victims that day has fallen, they still talk about it as a rise on the television.
Yeah,
now this to me is actually really insulting to anyone with half a brain cell. What you're doing is you're talking about a rise, when actually what's happened is there's been a fall in the number of coronavirus. It does seem that they're kind of talking it up, really.
Yeah. Well, it's quite interesting, because I looked at a website which has got an article by someone who has analysed the NHS statistics, and it's shown that since sort of about the beginning of April, there's been a constant downfall fall in the numbers of coronavirus victims, but also it also lists the number of people who've died from non-COVID reasons, which is really high, and of course is likely to be higher because a lot of people who've been denied treatment by a health service that hasn't been allowed to operate during the last couple of months. For example, cancer people, the referrals are down. Of course, they're down because people aren't able to visit their GP.
Yeah, I mean, another thing I've noticed as well is they're talking about the, I mean, we've seen graphics where yeah. they're, the, I mean, it was all most of people getting their information from the television, where they're saying actually the excess deaths yeah. at this time of year is very, very high. Well, they're not saying that many of those excess deaths are because of the lockdown.
Yep,
they're actually
exactly.
a direct result yep. of the thing that is supposed to be saving lives yeah, is actually
absolutely.
Killing people.
Absolutely. And of course, this is going to go on for some time because the cancer referrals, the cancer treatment was stopped on the 15th of April, which seemed a bit strange because we'd already passed the peak at that point. So people were allowed cancer treatment until the 15th of April, and then it suddenly stopped when
if you were a cynical person, you might say, well, this is just being used as a cover and an excuse for all sorts of censorship. I mean, for example, my show being taken yeah. off the air, but also of cutting back on the NHS.
Absolutely. And one thing that's quite interesting was that I tried to post this on my Facebook page, and within seconds the whole article kept disappearing, and I didn't have notification from Facebook to say that it was inaccurate information, and it was very difficult to call it inaccurate information.
Yeah,
because
what
it was
Facebook
from the
normally
NHS.
Do is they will have a little notice saying, oh, well, I'm sorry, we've had our independent fact checkers. They never explain who those independent yeah. fact checkers are.
I posted it several times, and each time it disappeared. And so then in the end, I wrote a little summary and did the URL link to it. So I did that this morning, so I haven't checked it yet, but that seemed to stay there. But it seemed as if it was purposefully being taken down. I could actually see it on my Facebook page, and I could actually see it disappearing. So when you get sort of like factual information that's quite reassuring, it looks to me as if it's disappearing.
Okay, so there's also been, I think it's fair to say, an enormous assault on medical intellectuals who are giving a very deep expert critique. So have you seen any evidence of that? I mean, I certainly yeah. have seen some of it.
Yes,
that.
Yes, I have.
Can you give us any examples?
Yeah, I mean, for example, the situation of hydroxychloroquine, which has been used in lots of cases in UK, in all over the world, in order to treat people with diseases that have an inflammatory immune response, such as systemic lupus, such as rheumatoid arthritis. So therefore, it was thought that maybe this, as in the cytokine storm stage of
right, because this is the cytokine storm is where basically the virus is creating an enormous immune response, but it's somehow managing to fight back against your T cells, your white blood cells, and whatever it is that's coming in yes. to fight the virus. It manages to turn them into basically it fights back,
yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
And so it creates yeah. a very traumatic situation in your body,
it
which means
indeed.
That your lungs stop working.
Well, it wasn't. In fact, what's been found in terms of the COVID virus is that it particularly attacks blood vessels, and that's why people with heart disease, for example, couldn't breathe because their blood vessels that were being attacked and narrowed. And so, therefore, it was felt that maybe hydroxychloroquine could be quite useful, and they combined it with a specific antibiotic that also had anti-inflammatory properties. And they did this in France and apparently had some quite good results. So then other countries in the world started copying it. But almost immediately, the World Health Authorities actually said that you couldn't use this hydroxychloroquine without doing tests to see whether it was safe. Now, this was illogical because hydroxychloroquine, apart from the fact that it has a long history of safety in use against inflammatory disease, has an even longer history of being used effectively for malaria. So, and there were other medications that had been used, like, for example, heparin, which wasn't being they weren't asked to sort of like test the safety on this. Anyway, this argument went on for a time until tests were set up. Tests were set up in various countries, so you could actually then treat people with hydrochloroquine, but you were actually having to evaluate their treatment and get the consent of the person to go into the trial. But as soon as that started to happen, up came this report in The Lancet, which actually said that patients who'd been in trials in hydrochloroquine had actually deteriorated rather than improved. So all of the trials immediately stopped.
Oh, well, hang on, because that's not what I'd seen. Around about a week or maybe 10 days before that, there was a report in the Daily Mail from a New York study that said that the hydrochloroquine treatment had actually saved 50% of the COVID-19 patients that they were thought were going to die. So it was actually doing an incredible job in saving 50% of the patients. So this seems to me like what's going on here is an intellectual and a kind of propaganda battle over what is actually quite a specialist topic.
Well, if I could tell you about the article in The Lancet, it was actually linked to a small company in United States, which basically consisted of three employees, one of which was a medical person who had a dubious reputation, and the others were people like sci-fi writers and things like this. And so the article was totally discredited.
Well,
and
hang on, that's fiction, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. The article was totally discredited and had to be withdrawn. But meanwhile, of course, all of the trials had been stopped, and the numbers of patients with the COVID bacteria had actually gone down so low that it was no longer possible to have trials. I think I did hear that a trial was still continuing in the United States, but they aren't. But it seems that by having this sort of like delay tactic, it means that now you can't really have any effective trials because the number of COVID sufferers has now become so low.
You said bacteria there. Was that a slip of the tongue?
It was a slip of the tongue, yes. I meant virus. Yeah. Right. Sorry about that.
Okay, so, it does seem as if there's this kind of, shall we say, strategic lying going on in the international press. So when the truth starts to come out, some massive, on the wire services and in all the national press, and the international press and the television, there's a mass release of a story to kill that truth. So that, it sounds like we're moving into this kind of propaganda world.
Well, it is, because, for example...
You'd probably be better off and stand a better chance of staying alive if you just switch your television off completely.
Yes, indeed. Except that if you happen to become ill, my brother happened to develop a pneumonia during the COVID outbreak, wasn't able to see a doctor, became really seriously ill because he wasn't able to get medical attention. This wasn't a COVID reason.
He's here in the UK.
He's here in the UK, in London. He's younger than me. He's in his late 60s. He's slim built. He's fit. And yet he happened by coincidence to get this bacteria in this case. It wasn't a virus. And it was difficult to get it diagnosed because he couldn't see a doctor. Eventually he did get the right diagnosis. But the thing about pneumonia is it really is quite a serious disease that needs treating. And it's taken him sort of like over 2 months before he's really started to really feel that he can start going outside again. But the other strange thing, having taken antibiotics for 6 weeks, he stopped the antibiotics, and of course, as one does when one stops antibiotics, he got terrible diarrhea, and then he started feeling really ill with this diarrhea. So he rang his GP surgery to say, could he speak to the GP because he was feeling ill because he'd had this diarrhea for 3 days, and the receptionist said to him, "Oh, you've got to self isolate for 2 weeks. You've got the COVID bacteria." So he was diagnosed by a receptionist on the end of the phone, and still couldn't see a doctor.
Okay, so anyway, the Off Guardian has published recently an article entitled "Is the coronavirus a psychological operation?" Now, what they're saying is that it's review what the features and outcomes of the coronavirus scare, they call it. Obviously, this is a real virus. It's killing people. But it seems from what you're saying, and I certainly agree, that there's an attempt to actually massively increase the fear factor, you know, to sort of scare people using the media. In fact, the government has said, I think, in some of the published SAGE advice, that that's exactly what the media must
absolutely.
Do. And they're saying that it shares some things in common with the Red Scare that drove the perceived threat of communism and the Muslim Scare behind the perceived threat of terrorism. Here are a dozen characteristics that these perceived threats share. And if you want to say anything about any of them, just stop me and we can talk about that. Fear-based and globally directed, media saturation with a bias towards fear, data manipulation and propaganda, censorship of opposing views. Now, I think you probably got something to say about that, haven't you? Because, I mean, you've seen, I think, you know, and I've seen various opposing views just simply being stopped.
Absolutely. For example, Dr. Judy Mitovits was said right at the beginning that the structure of the virus was such that it couldn't have possibly been mutated on its own. It must have been a manufactured virus. And of course, it did begin in Wuhan, where they've actually got an institute of virology that does research on coronavirus funded by US.
Actually, it's funded by the Pentagon, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't know who it's funded by exactly, but I know it is funded by US, and it's also got links with United States universities, like the University of Texas.
What you've brought up here is this big question, the big question about the virus, which is it man-made or not? Now, that hasn't really been addressed at all.
No, absolutely.
By our, you know, all the billions of pounds that goes into the national media, the international media, the BBC, etc. They really have just stepped round this question.
Absolutely,
completely.
They have, and it seems, you know, it seems that nobody has thought of this coincidence.
Except Richard Dearlove, who in the Daily Telegraph last week,
exactly,
he's the former head of MI6.
Yeah, exactly, because Dr. Judy Mitovits was just completely wiped out from YouTube. They wouldn't accept anything of hers, and she was like totally discredited once she'd made this statement. But then up comes Sir Richard Dearlove and actually announces that this is a man-made virus that must have escaped accidentally. So he was actually on the same line. But it hasn't been, I think that although that has appeared in a mainstream newspaper, it hasn't been picked up by, for example, the BBC.
Well, the intellectuals and the government have denied it. But then, hang on a minute, we reported, I'm talking about the BCFM politics show, when we were still on FM, I think it was the 7th of February, we reported a report, well, it was literally the week that the Chinese released a genome. In India, there was a whole load of brainstorming of virologists went on. They had a look at this genome and they said, well, over a couple of days, and they immediately released an unpeer-reviewed report saying, because of the importance of this virus, we're going to release this, and, you know, we can peer-review it at some other point, but we're going to release this straight away. And they said that they had seen SARS and AIDS protein insertions into this coronavirus. So that would make quite a good explanation as to why this coronavirus hadn't actually caused the common cold. It was doing something completely different. And it would also explain why that you've got this kind of cytokine storm and fighting back of the virus against your body's immune system.
Yeah.
So amazingly, that's what, February, March, April, May, we're now in June, that's 4 months ago. This was out there. We were reporting it. Now we've been taken off the airwaves. It does seem as if there's an attempt to sort of steer, really to kill and strangle journalism.
Exactly. I absolutely agree with that. That it seems to me as if there is a discourse of the virus being extremely dangerous, and there is a counter discourse that's allowed because, of course, the media has to have a debate, and
it is dangerous, surely.
That counter, well, Well, it's as dangerous as flu, and I've nursed people dying with flu. I'm not underestimating how serious a condition flu can be, but it is as dangerous as flu. But it particularly affects the elderly, and it particularly affects those who've got other diseases. I mean, for example, I think there's 1,318 people died in UK which has only got coronavirus listed on their death certificate. 1,318. So you've had a disease going around for some 4 months in which we've got 1,300 cases, 300 a month. No one would think on listening to the news that the numbers of people dying with coronavirus only is so low.
So this is another thing which is part of the propaganda, is it's with coronavirus or of coronavirus.
Yeah.
That's another complete
Exactly. If you have somebody with end-stage cancer or somebody with dementia or somebody with diabetes, particularly if they're overweight with the diabetes, they seem to be much more vulnerable to dying. But they were people who were probably going to die in the near future anyway. The life expectancy of these people was probably in terms of months. So the COVID virus might have perhaps accelerated their death, but the main reason why they were dying was because they had cancer or dementia or diabetes. That was the main reason.
Okay, so yeah. We've seen, we've talked a bit about the evidence from New Delhi and from India about this being a man-made virus rather than some sort of natural thing, which the press don't seem to want to talk about. We've also seen that the, I mean, it's just, we can carry on, I suppose, look through the, finish off the list from this Off Guardian article. Yeah. So we would talk about censorship of opposing views, intelligence agency control of information, preceded by, an exercise or exercises mimicking the threat, which we saw with the ID 2020, the I think it was called Event 201, organised by Bill Gates and the CIA, which happened just before the outbreak in Wuhan, and the series of claims made that are later proven false. Well, we've seen a lot of that as well,
exactly.
In this whole COVID business. The response is... it's got a threatened democracy. That's one of the things that all these have in common. Large increase in wealth and power for a few. Increase in social inequality. Well, we've seen around about $500 billion flow into the pockets of a handful of a few billionaires, including Amazon's Jeff Bezos and Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg. An increase in government control of the public and reduce individual freedoms. Response kills far more than the original threat. And evidence for manufactured events. So this is, I think, well, you know, I'll put a link up on our show page to this Off Guardian article, but ultimately it ushers us towards a kind of police state that many people in Britain have embraced the lockdown. This is a great
absolutely.
Thing. We're afraid of catching this. We understand the threat.
Yeah. And the left is tending to take the line that the lockdown needs to be harsher. I know that there's other thing that's happening is that a lot of people who are actually taking some sort of power from this. I mean, just an example, there's a very nice lady, I'm not criticizing her personally, but she's where I go shopping. She's very sort of like mild and gentle sort of person. And doesn't normally have any sort of like power at all, maybe because of her fear or maybe because she's actually been given the power. When you go to the supermarket now, she's one of the most sort of like officious people, really. Just get back, don't stand on the other side of that line, don't. And then if you stand so that you're a little bit to the left of the Perspex screen, get back behind the Perspex screen. And she's sort of like making these commands, and I think that whereas normally she's not able to make any imposition on people, she's able to make these to turn into this little sort of like power person.
Well, what would you say to those people who are really strong believers in the lockdown and all of this?
Yeah, it is really difficult. I mean, I do sort of like try to, like, for example, a friend who is a Labour Party local politician and a very nice person. But she's really, really anti the schools starting opening up again. So I've sent her some good research literature, including things from, for example, the University of Bonn, from the BMJ, so that they're actually really good sources, and said to her, have a look at these, because I think that, you know, the threat to schools has been over-exaggerated, and it'll be good for children to get back. But she hasn't come back to me, and I think it is quite difficult to, once people have accepted within the paradigm of thinking that that a certain thing is happening. The thing is, it does take sort of like a number of sort of like approaches from different angles, and if that doesn't happen, then the person who's coming along, like you or I, are seen as the extremists, the irrational, the people who are dangerous, rather than the people who are genuinely saying.
But it has really divided society,
yes,
hasn't it?
Absolutely divided, and very nastily. You know, like a group of people that I know, that my dancing class where we normally meet, I actually said that I was doing something that wasn't quite within the guidelines, and somebody responded by saying, you should be ashamed of yourself. And I'm thinking, this is a friend, you know, and she's not saying, oh dear, you're naughty, but actually saying, you should be ashamed of yourself, you know. And I just find that response sort of like really as frightening as the thing that's actually happening.
Well, totally understandable. But, yeah, you know, we've also seen, haven't we, a lot of change. I think I've seen a lot of change in search engines like Google, because you can be searching for something which you know all the search terms, you put the title in and everything, it's not there.
Yeah.
Then you use a different search engine and it pops up. There it is, right at the very top.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we did at the National Union of Journalists a debate a few years ago at the what they call DM, which is the kind of democratic place where everyone comes together, a delegate meeting, about Google being used to skew results for politicians. But this is a whole area which is being used. I mean, the idea is that the surveys in the States have shown that it's very, very easy for Google to just click, 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 and you get positive results about one politician, and click, 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 and you get negative results about another one. So they're obviously in a position to take money in order to make someone look better or look worse.
Absolutely.
Now, they can do the same sort of thing, and they are doing, quite obvious to me. I mean, I would suggest you go on Google and look for the film The Truth About Vaccines. You know, what with the coronavirus vaccine potentially coming down the line, obviously there's a big debate there to be had about how, you know, much money is in vaccines. So that film, you will not find it on Google, and yet it's the main thing. If you put The Truth About Vaccines in, it should be at the top. It's not. So there's a lot of, you know, censorship on all sorts of levels. This one, so I'm boiling down to say here, it's coming across as actually binning of real journalism, binning of real free speech, strangling of real journalism, and an assault on intellect, really.
Yeah. Well, absolutely. I mean, when you talk about power, I mean, power doesn't just exist on one level, it exists on all levels. And what I've been really surprised about is how quickly people have internalized this new reality, this new strange reality that that they shouldn't be embracing. I mean, for example, my daughter has got three children aged between 15 going down to 9, is just like, can't believe that none of them are missing their friends, that they actually have built this sort of like new world that they seem to be content
to exist. Well, maybe seeing them on social media.
Yeah, they're seeing them on social media, and they seem to be content with that, and content to not have not go back to school, not meet up with their friends. They're not even attempting to meet up with their friends.
Well, we're going into this world now where it's okay to be against the lockdown, against the government or against these policies, but you're not allowed to back it up with an intellectual argument.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So where are we heading with all that then? Because that sounds to me actually like, you know, the end of free speech, the end of real intellect in this country. If you're going to do that for something so important as the pandemic, you're just going to ban intellectual responses against what the government is planning. And it may even be the government is pushing back against that. But there's something else going on a much bigger international level.
Exactly, there is. Yeah, I mean, I think that, for example, a lot of, when you look at the SAGE reports, until sort of Ferguson came along, it seemed as if the government was definitely sort of like leaning towards, you know, not taking such extreme reaction. And of course, taking similar action to Sweden. But as soon as the Imperial College sort of model stepped in, then almost straight away, they adopted the more extreme versions. And the other thing now, of course, despite there being so much research saying that masks aren't very effective, strangely enough, at the very end of the epidemic, suddenly they're expecting people to wear masks.
Well, they're not expecting everybody, are they? They're expecting poor people who have to use public transport to use masks. Also, you have to, if you're going to have any hospital treatment, you've got to wear a mask.
Yeah.
And yet, are you saying that the evidence was that the masks aren't really that effective?
I think the only evidence of places where masks are effective are in enclosed spaces where you actually have somebody who is known to be a COVID
carrier.
This
is the other point, is apparently the COVID-19 is dying out. And it's
absolutely. It is. Look, if you
and yet suddenly you've got to then do something which you maybe should have done 5 months ago.
And things like isolating people when they move into UK. I mean, I had a friend that came back from Australia at the peak of the epidemic, and she was quite amazed because she was able to walk in through Heathrow Airport. There were no posters, there was no leaflets, there was no advice that she was self-isolate. She'd actually heard from the internet that she'd got to self-isolate for 2 weeks, so she did that. And you came in to from New Zealand, but there was no suggestion that anyone should self isolate. Even for example, the outbreak in Liverpool happened because they allowed fans from Spain, from a place which had a very high COVID outbreak, to actually go. They allowed the fans to go to Liverpool, and that caused a sort of like the outbreak in Liverpool. So there was no suggestion of self-isolating when the virus was at its highest. And now that it's almost at the point of dying down, they're bringing in things like masks and self-isolation.
It almost seems to me like it's an enormous insult to your one's intelligence to be told you've got to wear a mask when the evidence is, number one, that the mask is really not going to make much difference, and secondly, that there's no... So it's almost like if you put a mask on, you're exhibiting your irrationality, and yet you're enforced. You've got to do that.
Yeah, it's a sort of like an exercise in control, isn't it? Where you're, you know, for example, if you know that the speed limit is 30, but you might sometimes drive at 32 miles an hour in a 30 miles an hour limit, intellectually you say, well, this isn't very much different to 30, and this piece of road hasn't got any pedestrians or any other cars, so it's okay. And you can sort of like intellectualize and sort of like work out that that's okay. But you're not allowed to do it with the masks, not only from the point of view of any censorship by the government or even any penalties by the government, but because of the censorship of your fellow human beings.
Amazing. Anyway, where do you think we're heading with all of this? Because we're being told that you're going to have to continue to wear masks if you're going to go in for any hospital treatment. And you're going to have to, if you're using public transport, really until there's a vaccine arrives. And that certainly the record of the vaccine companies is pretty horrific in many, many cases. I mean, say, for example, even a hepatitis B vaccine, which is given to infants, you can't catch it through anything except intravenous injections, and you can't catch it through... I think you can also catch it through sex acts.
Yeah.
I mean, but what is the point of giving that to an infant that's just been born? It doesn't really seem to make any sense at all. So there's an irrationality in the vaccine world as well. But we've got to be told that we can only get out of this mask world, and once we add this vaccine, which is coming from these companies that have got a track record of absolute I mean, death and murder, really.
Yeah, in, absolutely.
I mean, just before this lockdown started, Judith, we had did a programme about the documentary which aired on the BBC back in November one evening called Cold Case Hammarskjöld. And it was an investigation into the far-right white supremacist private army in South Africa that killed the Secretary General of the United Nations, I think it was in 1963, Dag Hammarskjöld, because he was there trying to stop a war and the big mining companies didn't want him to, so they got this private army to kill him. But at the towards the end of that investigation that the Swedish filmmakers and the Danish investigative journalists were doing down in South Africa, they discovered absolute cast iron evidence and witness testimony that AIDS was being deliberately injected into black Africans to kill them as a result of, or under the guise of, being a vaccination program.
Yeah.
So we're going to vaccinate you against AIDS. What they were really doing was curing, getting black people to queue up to be injected with AIDS. So what we've got here is the vaccine question is going to definitely
Absolutely.
Going to be coming down the line.
Absolutely.
What do we do?
I know, and it is an incredible problem. And I'm not against vaccines per se. I think that there's a lot of vaccines that do a lot of good. I've had vaccinations myself.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
I think the other thing to interrupt you again is I did a whole load of reporting on Gulf War syndrome years ago.
Yeah.
And it became absolutely clear to me from all the evidence I saw that the Gulf War syndrome with these people coming back from fighting, this is, I think it was during the first Gulf War in around 1990, that the British military personnel had been injected with loads of different vaccines and serums stuff all at the same time.
Yeah.
So one of them on its own might have been okay for your body, but when you get 10 at once, it just overwhelms your immune system and it can damage you permanently.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's exactly what's happening with vaccines now. So the vaccines are being approved as an individual vaccine, and then they're being
combined.
Given to infants, which they haven't been approved for, and they're also being combined into sometimes 5 or 6 different vaccines in one shot.
Yeah, and I mean, the quite interesting thing is that I read a study that showed that people who had a flu vaccine were actually 30% more likely to catch the coronavirus. It actually increased their chances of getting the coronavirus. And yet I still see now that there's a government campaign to try and get people to have the flu vaccine, almost as if they must have read the same research as me. If it hasn't gone to Sage, then I'd like to know why it didn't go to Sage. It was in the BMJ. So therefore, they should be, if they want to get rid of the coronavirus, they really should be distracting people from having a flu vaccine. But they've got a campaign now saying it's not too late to have the flu vaccine, and the one that's circulating now is very effective for the circulating for the vaccine and the circulating flu are compatible, so it would be very effective. But now in summer people don't get flu, so why have they got a campaign to say that at the very time that in research in the BMJ has actually shown that if you take the flu vaccine it's going to increase your chances of getting coronavirus? But I think that I've been trying to find a vaccine against the coronavirus since the 1960s. I mean, for example, there was research at the Common Cold Research Centre at Porton Down, for which a lot of students went to.
Okay, so that was actually a little bit up from Porton Down. It was in Salisbury, because I was a reporter there at the BBC. I did a report on the Common Cold Research Centre. I think it was called Harvard Hospital at the south end of Salisbury. So.
Yeah.
Although it was actually part of Porton Down, we've since found, and I think it's Steve Brody, he was the Home Affairs correspondent for Points West, did a massive expose 10 years or so ago explaining how Porton Down guinea pigs had been murdered by Porton Down, by the military experimenting with these sorts of viruses on them.
Yeah, yes, because you could go there as a student, have 2 weeks paid holiday, and then you were given coronaviruses. So there's been research going on for coronaviruses since the 1960s, to my knowledge, and I don't actually know a researcher, an American researcher, who's been researching coronavirus, and he said that because coronavirus, like flu virus, tends to mutate quite quickly, and there's been 30 mutations of this particular particular coronavirus already now, that you're never going to have an effective vaccine for coronavirus. It's just like you're never going to have a truly effective vaccine for flu. The influenza vaccine gives you a 10% reduced chance of getting flu. It doesn't stop you having flu. And I don't feel it's worthwhile having a vaccine to give me a 10% immunity when it's a disease that I've only had twice in my life.
Well, and also when the vaccines can have all sorts of nasty side effects too. But anyway, look, just to wind up, what can we do about this? It's an assault on intellect. It's a censorship. The idea is we're trying to bring in some sort of contact tracing system, which could end up being a bit like the sort of surveillance that you get in China, which has been going on with the sort of enormous amounts of personal information and profiling going on of individuals. So what can we do about it all, Judah?
Well, I mean, it almost seems as if, you know, they've won, except that whoever they are. But I just think that this is too important an issue, because this is a question of the mass population, the mass imprisonment of world population with the consent of that population. And I just feel that that means that whilst that's happening, the super elites can treat us as they wish, both our wealth, both our health, our survival. And so I think it's a really important matter. I think that like-minded people have initially got to find a way of communicating with each other and meeting with each other, so that we can actually, instead of just protesting, but actually devise a plan so that we can have counter-information that will start being effective. But I think that's difficult to do whilst the lockdown. And I think the other difficult thing is that it's difficult to do whilst so many of us are communicating via social media, because the powers that be are going to know that we're communicating, are going to have advance notice.
Well, the thing is, Mark Zuckerberg at Facebook is making so much money out of the lockdowns and the virus that he's not going to allow the intellectuals to get out through his platform. And I think the only positive thing I'd like to say, really, is that I think the elite have possibly gone too far. There's lots and lots of people out there who don't believe that the virus and the lockdown has been effective. Yeah. The people in this country have led the government out of the lockdown by actually by their actions. The government's realising, well, we can't control people that much, so we're going to have to just ease off a little bit. So maybe there is a bit of hope there.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, the government are trying to open schools, but the difficulty is that the unions are sort of like have stopped it happening. I think we have to, this is so important, Tony, that I think that somehow or other we have to find a way through this to actually inform more people of what's going on.
And we also, I think we need to be quite clear about what we do want, which is a sort of manifesto for social justice, rather like the yellow vests in Paris had. Because, of course, this is another, we haven't even mentioned, that whole movement was getting very militant, very powerful, threatening the government. And now, of course, it's been totally criminalised.
Yeah, and exactly the same has happened in India, of course, with the nationalist law passed, which discriminated strongly against Muslims. The Muslim community was protesting against it, and now they've been criminalised as well. So it's not only happening in France; it's happening in other places too.
If you could just remind us of some of those websites to do with Yemen and also possibly to do with the virus that you recommend.
There's Middle East Eye, which is a Middle East magazine, and also the other, Sana'a Center for Strategic Studies, which is an academic site run by Yemenis, and in which they give regular updates of what's happening and also discussion on important topics in Yemen.
And I would thoroughly recommend the Off Guardian website, who seems to be doing a superb job on the coronavirus. And actually, I think in a way, it means that everybody is going to have to get engaged in this to actively go out and find the truth. It seems to me that we're being swamped by propaganda and lies, very much like in Nazi Germany, actually, because one of the things that people forget is that even during the war, the Second World War, we didn't block the Nazi propaganda service, which was in English, which was William Joyce broadcasting Lord Haw-Haw.
Yeah.
We didn't. There was a decision made. No, we'll let Lord Haw-Haw broadcast, and then we'll have things on the BBC satirising him and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But the idea, as soon as you start censoring it, basically you've lost the argument.
Yeah. I think there is this other website which I've recently discovered in America called Hector Drummond. They've got some quite amazing journalists covering quite a lot of things that directly linked to UK, like NHS data, the SAGE minutes, and they're doing a really good job on that.
Well, that's the other thing to say, I suppose, is that we've got to think of ourselves, I suppose, as in the English language, as in solidarity with campaigners in the US as well.
Absolutely.
Okay, Judith Brown, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
So that's Dr. Judith Brown from Somerset speaking to me earlier this week. One thing to add from that, though, and there are various people who have sent me, well, I think, a fascinating article. Well, it's not an article, it's a book, very quickly written by a guy called Logan Christopher. And the, I suppose, pinch point in all of this has been the World Health Organization. These are the guys who now is the main funding for the World Health Organization comes from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. It's effectively being privatized. It's not governments paying for this organization, this arm of the United Nations anymore. And Logan Christopher has looked at the World Health Organization and published this e-book called Corruption of the World Health Organization. Now, he looks at all sorts of historical problems with it, and specifically has a whole section of the book looking at the guy who's in charge, Tedros Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, who is the Director General of the World Health Organization, and his history, who he is and who owns him, who pulls his strings, and also the enormous amounts of industry input. For example, the tobacco industry inputting into the World Health Organization is pretty eye-opening. The enormous amount of money that's been being channeled to World Health Organization people from the big pharmaceutical companies, the World Health Organization fueling the opioid epidemic is one chapter. And it just goes on and on. The swine flu, H1N1 pandemic, he looks at particularly, as well as the conflicts of interest, the Chernobyl and the World Health Organization's reaction to that, Fukushima and the World Health Organization's reaction to that. It goes on and on. But anyway, I'll put a link up to Corruption of the World Health Organization by Logan Christopher on our show page. His website, loganchristopher.com, and our show page, thisweek.org.uk. So, thanks very much to Dr. Judith Brown. Time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest in the first hour. Well, he wasn't really a guest. He's always on, isn't he? That's Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. You can download our MP3s and listen in the car or anywhere you like, actually. You'll find this week's podcast, story links and comment page, and our contact details at thisweekoneword.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend. There's Sunday evenings at 7 with Danny Lopsch, a particularly good show to have a listen to. And BCFM boss Pat Hart did say our sister show Dialect would be on BCFM every Monday at 10 p.m. So far it hasn't been. We'll be back on FM soon when other shows return on the week of the 20th of June, hopefully, Pat Hart willing. Do please join us for the Politics Show live stream at the old time at 5 o'clock next Friday. God bless. And don't let the banksters get you down.